is Captain Frank Mummert with the Maryland School of Sailing and Seamanship. In this episode, Captain Tom Tersey and I discuss some of the things that we consider to be important in doing the Delmarva circumnavigation class that we teach several times a year. Let's listen. Welcome all of our participants. Once again, I got this great long list of people, so I'm very glad to see you. I see a lot of names that I've seen before. I want to say thank you to all the people who stopped by at the booth at the boat show and said hi. Very nice to meet most of you, a lot of you. Today, we're going to be talking about our Delmarva circumnavigation. Not so much from the Delmarva circumnavigation, but from why we do what we do and the things that we do to make it safe for ourselves and for our students. I want to start out by saying, Tom, you've been doing this for a couple of years now, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
You started it.
And the school's been doing it for like 30 years. We've done well over 100 of these Delmarvas, maybe 150 for all I know. So
yeah, it's been a big number. So why did you decide to do the Delmarva the way you did?
Well, we wanted to do an advanced coastal cruise, training cruise, and we wanted that to be really representative of a serious advanced coastal cruise as opposed to just a cruise within the bay. So we thought that should include some ocean and a whole variety of conditions as you go around the Delmarva Peninsula. So we feel that it's a very comprehensive cruise in terms of the variety of conditions that you encounter and that you have to deal with. So we thought this was very representative. We used to also do some up to New England and some down to Florida, you know, as advanced coastals, but we focused eventually on this, the Delmarva, because first off, it's close to home. And then secondly, it has this variety of conditions, which I think is just very rich for what we do.
Yeah, the first actual Maryland school class that I went along as an instructor candidate was with Eric Peterson from Mystic to back to Norfolk, back to Rock Hall. And it was definitely an introduction to the process of Maryland school because, you know, the whole idea of big boat sailing long distance, particularly the offshore run down off the New Jersey coast, was a lesson in itself. It wasn't something that I was used to. I also remember years ago, we were doing three of them a year, and I did one, and Steve Runnels did one, and Jochen Hoffman did one, and you you came to us that year, and you said, you know what? I just want to go sailing. So I'm going to go sailing with you guys. I'll just be along as part of the crew.
And yeah, I served with you as first mate.
Yes, you did.
You were captain. I was first mate, right?
Yes. And you know, that was a unique experience for me because, you know, I'm sorry. I respect your abilities so much. And to have you say, you be in charge and I'll just do what you tell me to do. That was a unique experience. But what really came out of that for me was after that, you got the four of us together and said, you know what? Steve is doing this and it really, really works well. And then Jochen's doing this and this is really working out. And Frank's doing these other things. But what I want to do is I want to take all of that and create a program that says this is what we're going to do. And that has always been huge for me. The idea that we do this as a class, not as just a, hey, let's get everybody on a boat and go sailing. But these are the things we're going to do in order to teach these skills so that when people walk away from this class, they feel more confident in what they're doing.
Yeah, and what grew out of that was, of course, the training plan. So for everybody's information, we developed these training plans actually for all of our courses, and this one in particular for the Delmarva. So what we did is come up with a concept on the progression of training. And Frank, let me show my screen and show the chart for just a second. I'll just be very brief with this, but so Rita, I'm going to share my screen. I'm going to go there and I'm going to share it. Do you see the Delmarva chart?
I do.
I see it.
Okay. So just to give you all an idea that this is the Delmarva Peninsula, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia Peninsula. Here's Chesapeake Bay. Here's Delaware Bay. And here's the Atlantic Ocean. And here's Norfolk down here. And our home port is right here in Chester River. So basically, the cruise is to come out of Chester River and go up the bay. You see, it's very narrow here. And then go across this Chesapeake and Delaware Canal, and then down, which is a ship canal, and then down Delaware Bay, offshore in the Atlantic, into Cape Charles, and then go into Cape Charlestown here. And this, by the way, is like a 2 day or day and a half or 2 days, and then which includes at least one night passage and maybe a second night or a half a night. And then going up the bay, we do as an overnight up the bay as well, go into Annapolis or back to Rock Hall. So that's basically the program. It's 450 miles. And with this, you can see that there's a whole variety of conditions. And I personally believe that one of the most challenging legs of this cruise is a nighttime cruise up Chesapeake Bay. We've already done offshore at night, but this is pretty wide open. But coming up the bay, you have a lot of ship traffic. And at nighttime, we're having to deal with ships in the bay, narrow areas. So that becomes very challenging in that regard. So if I stop share, I get my screen back. Okay. So that basically is the route. And then we break it down into like an eight day course. So what we do, I'll give you very, very briefly, and the idea of this is there's a progression of training so that each leg builds on previous legs. So basically on Saturday, we're doing in-port boat inspections and sail handling at the dock and preparing navigation for the next day. Then Sunday, we get underway first thing in the morning. We do a compass calibration using the sun. We do a speedo calibration. We do sail handling underway and then go about 15 miles to a nearby Swan Creek and take a mooring ball there and prepare navigation for tomorrow. So we're now all on board, happy as larks. And then Monday, the next day, we get underway like first thing, 7 a.m., breakfast underway, 50 miles up the bay to the C&D Canal. And during that time, this is a very rich training period in which we do hands-on navigation underway, a lot of manual navigation, radar and AIS training, watch keeping training, radio operation, helming and course steering. And then we get into Summit North Marina on C&D Canal, top up our diesel and water, and we pump out the waste tanks. And we take a slip and we prepare navigation for the next 2 days because the next 2 days will be nonstop from this location on the C&D Canal down into Norfolk. And we're underway first thing in the morning, and there's about 150 miles down Delaware Bay in the Atlantic Ocean to Cape Charles. And during this time, as I said before, we have an overnight watch keeping, navigation, radar, AIS, all that sort of a thing, and really getting the experience in doing these things at night and on the day as well. And then Thursday, and there we get in on Wednesday evening, and Thursday we depart Cape Charles Town, and What we do is we're usually underway by about noontime because we got in late last night. And then we go the overnight up the bay, 120 miles or so up the bay. And then Friday morning, we arrive at Annapolis after the overnight sail. And we take a slip, we sit for the 106 exam, the ASA 106 exam, dinner on the town, prepare navigation for the next day. And then Saturday, we have a leisurely morning, return to our home marina, clean up the boat, top up the fuel and the water, and pump out the holding tank, have a graduation ceremony, and then the crew depart. So it's been quite an experience. And we're living with, six people on the boat for the whole week. So we get to know each other very well. And I believe it's a very rich learning experience. So those are.
I agree completely. I think that the two things that to me are the most effective are that run up the bay on Tuesday when we're going up toward the C&D Canal, because there is so much hands-on navigation training. All the stuff that you teach in the 105, that's where we're actually putting that into practice. And we've done running fixes and two and three bearing fixes and danger bearings and all those kind of things in a controlled environment. That's I because you know as you and I both know, as we go up the bay, we know the places that we're going to get these really good two bearing fixes, these really good running fixes, and we can work those into the process. But I think the other thing, there, I actually have a story on this. Like I never have a story, is the nighttime crew overboard, which this is the only time we do a nighttime crew overboard, and I've been doing it. About in the about where the Potomac and Chesapeake come together, because the conditions there, particularly if you've got offsetting tides and currents, can be really, really challenging for a boat handler to try and get the boat in position. But my favorite nighttime crew overboard story comes from before we started doing this. I had two crew members. I had two crew members asleep and two crew members on watch. We had four students and one instructor. And the rover had gone down to take the end of watch logs to update stuff. And I had the student on the wheel. I said, "I want you to go up onto the coach roof there, and I want you to clip in. And when I point at you, I want you to yell as loud as you can." Now, we were motoring, because we didn't have a lot of wind. I said, "I want you to yell as loud as you can, and I'm going to throw the MOB in the water, and we'll see what happens." Because we had already done the nighttime training crew overboard. This was a unannounced one. And so I throw the MOB in the water, and I point at the student, and he yells as loud as he can, and nothing. When it happened, I threw the wheel over, and the boat started this big spin, and nothing happened. And after we almost ran over the MOB in the water, so I spun the wheel back the other direction, and I pointed at the helmsman again, and he yelled again, and still nothing happened. And finally, the rover pokes his head up through the companionway and says, "Hey, where's John?" And I said, "He's not here." And I said, he said, "What's going on?" I said, "I'm not here." And he looked around and he realized he had a problem. And he comes running up, looks over the side, sees the MOB with the blinking strobe on it, and starts bringing the boat around to get it. And I said, "Do you think maybe you'd like to have some more crew up here?" And he goes, "Oh yeah." And he runs over to the companionway and starts yelling, "Man overboard, man overboard." And the two other students who were been sound asleep come bouncing up in their underwear and tethers and harnesses and clip in and bounce back and forth in the cockpit three or four times as they're trying to get focused. So after we recover the MOB and we take the boat out of gear and we're sitting in the cockpit, and I ask, the rover why he didn't do anything. And he said, I never heard it. Now, this guy, the helmsman, was sitting immediately above the nav station, and he was yelling as loud as he could. With the engine running, the rover could not hear him. And I had one of the students pulls out his phone and starts playing on his phone. And I said, is there something going on? He says, yeah, I'm sending a message to my daughter. Now, his daughter lived on board his Pearson 36 down in Texas. He said, I'm sending her a message to tell her she's not to take the boat out again until I get home and put some more gear on board, because I learned what can go wrong. And I think that is the best lesson you can take away from one of these things is, my God, this is not like what we do in the daytime. This is scary out here at night. And walking away from that is a good thing. That's my story.
So did you eventually get the MOB on board?
Oh, we did, yeah. Although the two guys who came up, like I said, they bounced off of each other because one of them clipped into one side of the cockpit, the other one clipped into the other side of the cockpit, and then they tried to work on the opposite side that they were clipped in on. And so they just bounced and wrapped themselves up. We have finally had to get things under control so they could get the MOB back on board. It took 10 minutes
Well,
easily.
you used the terminology rover, and I'd like to just outline why we have that terminology. That the way we set up the crew on this was six people on board. There's the captain, the first mate, two professionals, and then the four student crew. And with that, we have two student crew on watch for 6 hours during these long overnight runs. And one of those two is on the helm, and the other one is the rover. And we call them the rover to emphasize the fact that you're not supposed to be sitting planted in one spot like a potted palm. You're supposed to be up and around and moving around the boat, looking out, helping the helmsman view the scene, see what's coming. Go down and look at the navigation, go down, look at the AIS, the radar, and so forth, see what's approaching, identify the moving objects, the moving other boats that are there. And when you see a ship, we identify him on the AIS. And with that, we're able to get his size, his speed, his route, and everything. And we want to track that. So we want to be very attentive to other vessels, especially, well, day and night. So we call them the rover, and the rover is the on-watch navigator. At the end of 1 hour, they switch positions, and the helmsman now becomes the rover, and the rover becomes the helmsman. And that goes on for a 6 hour period until the other crew comes on. And then the captain and first mate are also on as observers and advisors and instructors, and that's how we proceed with the crew arrangements.
Yeah, and we've been doing this with the captain and mate, the master and mate, being shifted 3 hours so that as the master, I can evaluate both watch teams and still be comfortable. Again, I remember when we started out when the mat we before we started putting the mates on. I used to have to sleep in the cockpit so that I could keep track of everything. And you've definitely brought the game up. It is definitely a professional operation now. Not a just, like I said, it's not just a let's go sailing. It's a lesson. It's a program with a lesson all through it. In your opinion, what have been the some of the more interesting weather events that we've had during these this last 10 years or so?
Well, I've had many weather events, but the one that is memorable, in fact, Timmy, who's here tonight, was with me as first mate several couple of years ago when we hit a there was a big squall line running north and south for a couple of 100 miles, and it was coming across the bay on a north-south line, but it was traveling east. And we could see these huge black clouds to our west as we're coming up. This was still daylight, but just in the dusk period. So we prepared. We got the sails down. And my process for heavy duty squalls is to deal with it under sail, not under motor. And I mentioned some of this in the summer squalls chat that we did. But basically, I feel that you have more control of the boat when the winds really pipe up. So we saw this big black clouds coming. We got the boat prepared. We took down the head sails. We reefed the deep reefed the main. We closed up hatches. We buttoned zippered up the canvas and put some extra lashings on the bimini and various things like that. So we were fully prepared. And when it hit pretty hard. And we had like 50, maybe up to 60 knots for about a half hour, 40 minutes. And we just rode that on the deep reef main. And my instruction to the helmsman is to simply follow the wind around, because often when a squall comes through, a local squall, the wind is going to rotate in direction. And I don't want the wind to get in back of us, because then the cockpit is exposed, the companionway is exposed, and you're in a much safer, better position to face the storm as opposed to have your back to it. And so we did. So we rode it around. We went probably in some circles. I don't know that we fully went around because it was not so much local, it was a spread out storm. So it was pretty much straight line winds. And we just rode fine. So that's one that I recall very, very vividly.
Many years ago, I was listening to you talk to a student at the boat show about this class, and the question was, how much do you sail? And what you told him was, about one third of the time we sail, about one third of the time we motor sail, about one third of the time we have to motor. Do you find that still to be a true statement?
Yeah, the other thing is you have to set your mind, and a lot of times our beginning crews don't have their perspective the same as my perspective. When you're on a cruise, you're going from point A to point B. You want to get to point B. You don't want to screw around sailing at 1.5 knot speed and take 14 days to complete the cruise. So the idea is that on a cruise, you want to go and you use whatever propulsion is available to you. If there's lots of wind, you sail fully. And if there's only a little bit of wind, you might motor sail or motor. But basically, yeah, I find that that's the case. Although sometimes we have a really good sailing cruise, where we've had 15 to 18 knots most of the time, and it's just wonderful, a wonderful trip.
Yeah,
And
I remember a trip a couple of years ago where I came back into the marina on like a Friday afternoon, thinking you were going to be in Saturday around lunchtime, and Navigator was already in. And I said, "You know, what happened?" And you said, "It just was great sailing. We never even slowed down." And now I have to contrast that with a sailing trip I did 8 9 years ago, where off the I off the RP safe water buoy at the mouth of the Rappahannock River, we had been forced to. It was one of those summer classes where we were motoring way more than we wanted to, and we had finally gotten like 10, 12 knots of wind. And the crew said, can we sail it? And I said, okay, well, what we'll try is we'll try to sail it. Let's see what happens. And we sailed for 4 hours, tacking, because we were sailing into the wind with an outgoing tide. And we sailed for 4 hours and were a half mile north of the RP mark. And at that point, everybody was like, yeah, we understand now. Sometimes you're just going to have to motor, particularly in the Chesapeake Bay section where you've got the tides going up and down. You can find yourself running up with the tide and having a great, you know, speed over ground, and then the tide changes and all of a sudden you're doing two. Why do we do it the way we do? Why do we do the clockwise rotation? I have students every now and again say, well, why don't we do the run down the bay first? Because that's easier, and then do the offshore part where you know, you're actually out in the ocean. You have anything on that?
Actually, it depends on two things, really. Our location north and south in the bay. In other words, we are up 3/4 of the way up the bay, and that gives us a 50-mile leg up to the C&D Canal, which is perfect for the training level we want to do at that stage of the cruise. If we were down south in the bay, our home port, 50 miles, north of the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, we would probably go the other direction. So our reason for going clockwise is really because it fits best with our training progression plan. If we start way up north in the bay and go south for a day and a half going down, that doesn't serve our training progression as well. So our reason is basically that.
Yeah, I think the other thing I've found is that if, by doing the offshore leg first, people get used to sailing at night without having a lot of things around that they need to worry about. Where coming back up the bay, you have to really be focused on your navigation. There's a whole lot more things moving in the bay at night going up the bay, and the monsters are definitely out there.
We have training plans for this, as I said, and for all of our courses, but the training plan defines very specifically and in great detail what we do each day of that cruise. And each of those days that I outlined earlier is defined in that training plan. So it's as Frank said before, it's not just going out and sailing and having fun. We're having fun. But we also want to accomplish certain, which we feel are important goals. And when we developed a training plan initially, we asked the question okay, what are the activities that we have to do in order to complete this cruise? So going up the bay, what are the activities that we want to complete? Going down Delaware Bay, going offshore. So we listed the activities that we thought were important, and then we went and defined in great detail each of those activities. So even if you don't do a Delmarva, getting a copy from our school store of that book will serve you very well in doing some future planning of your own.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions that have come in, so I'm going to go ahead and read these questions now, and we can, if we go off on another tangent, we can. The first question is, when sailing through the squall, where do you try to keep the wind relative to the boat?
Yeah, well, I try to keep it at about 50 degrees apparent wind angle. And if I'm sailing under this condition with only the deep reef main, that's probably as close to the wind as I can be. But basically, I want to stay as close to the wind as possible without tacking, and go in a circle if I have to follow the wind around. I just don't want the wind in back of me.
Right. Yeah, and the windage, particularly on high winds, the windage on the bow of the Island Packet 40 acts almost like a deep reef main or a deep reefed headsail. Maybe I read it incorrectly on the website, but don't you sometimes start and end in the Norfolk area?
We have not, and it's simply a logistics issue,
Well, but
based on where we're located.
Jay, I think what you probably read was the Bermuda trips. The Bermuda trips do start and end in the Norfolk area, and then we do what we call the 104E. It's a 10. It's a ASA 104 course. The E is for extended because it's one extra day, and that is bringing Navigator back up to Rock Hall. From Norfolk. So we do that. That's not a 106. We're going to stop every night. Next question. If I understand correctly, this cruise slash course is a 106 level. What prerequisites are required for this course? Also, can I use the Canadian Power and Sail courses as prerequisites?
Well, there are actually two requirements from our standpoint. One, number one, do you have the past sailing experience and training that qualifies you for this level of cruise? In other words, we don't want to have beginning sailors on this. We want to have experienced sailors because it's an experience level cruise. So we have two tracks that have to be satisfied. One is, if you have enough experience to do the cruise, you can do the cruise even if you're not getting ASA certification. But if you want ASA certification, then the prerequisites are to have all of the lower level ASA keelboat certs, which are 101, 103, 104, and 105 is the navigation. So you need those if you want the ASA cert, but if you don't have, if you're not going after the ASA cert, you can still do the cruise if you have enough experience to qualify. And our website defines the prerequisites in the qualification for this.
Yeah, and expanding on that just a little bit, the 101, 103, 104 classes, basically, if you sign up, you're going to get to take the class. With the 106, we actually, Tom and I actually review the resumes, and we'll offer you a berth if we think you're ready. It's you really, because we're going to be offshore, because we're going to be offshore for more than 24 hours, we need to be sure that the four students on board are capable of making the trip. So there is a certain amount of, even if you've done 101, 103, 104, 105, we really want to know that you're going to be okay. The other thing I'm going to say is that even if you haven't done 101, 103, 104, you can take the course, but I would highly recommend that you do some navigation course. Tom's 105 is amazing, and he teaches everything you're going to need to know in a very controlled manner. But even if you don't do his 105, if you're going to do a 106, even if you're not going to get certified, you should have that level of navigation training, because 106 is the practical for the 105.
And related to that is the fact that the navigation preparation is done by the entire crew. The four student crew with our oversight prepares the navigation. We have everybody participate in that preparation activity so that everybody knows what the course is going to be, what the potential hazards are, what are the opportunities. So they need to know in detail ahead of time. We don't want one person doing the navigation prep and then the rest of the crew is kind of dumb on it. So everybody participates in each of those nav prep days.
Yeah. And
Frank, excuse me, let me just add to that. And when we do the nav prep, we do it all on paper and pencil charts, paper charts, paper and pencil navigation. Once we finish that and we have it entered in our logbook as far as our cruise plan for that leg, we then go to our electronics, our multifunction plotter, and program in waypoints. And during the cruise, we use both the paper chart and the plotter charts in conjunction.
Yeah. Question, how does the tides affect the trip on the Delaware River? Do you have to time the trip up or down the river per the tide?
Well, my reaction to that is, look, the tide goes this way and it goes that way. And in the end, it just averages out. So I personally, when I leave the C&D canal for that leg down, I do it on people time as opposed to, now Frank may do it differently. Some guys like to get up at 3 a.m. and go early, you know, to hit the tide. But I figure, look, by the time I get down to Cape Henlopen and into the Atlantic Ocean, the tide's going to go both ways. So when it's against me, I'm going to be frustrated. When it goes with me, I'm going to be exhilarated. So I don't worry about it in that regard.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Eric years ago made the point that if you're going up the bay, tides can help you, but going down the bay, it's going to shift during the trip. And so you're either going to be slowed down at the first half or you're going to be slowed down at the second half, but you're not going to make it down there fast enough to make a difference.
Yeah, years ago I did a trip from Cape May at the southern end of the Delaware Bay on up to Philadelphia in a sailboat, and I had an engine and we basically motored up, but I hit the tide just right where the flood was just beginning when we're departing Cape May, and we rode that hump all the way up, and we still had current with us going northbound, but that's a rarity.
Yeah, I've had that happen with the Chesapeake. Catch it at the coming out of Cape Charles City and catch the incoming tide and be able to ride the that all the way up to Solomon's before it starts to turn. Let's see. This is not a question, it's a comment. My instructor for my 104 class also had us navigate the course before we left. Yes. I don't know. I don't know if you took it with us, but yeah. That is a requirement in our 104 class that we do the paper-based navigation as part of the prep for the 104. The only difference is we don't have the electronics on the 32s, so we're doing everything by paper. We're doing a DR and we do fixes and all that stuff. We're doing that at the 104. But there, we get a lot of students who come to us just for the 106 level, and they have never done it before. So that's part of the reason why we're so on teaching that. I've got a question. What about current in the C and D? Oh, current in the C and D, yeah.
Yeah, they run pretty strong. I mean, they go 2, 2.5 knots in there. Well, Delaware Bay does also. It goes easily 2.5 knots.
Yeah, but the thing about the C and D is that you hit that western edge of the C and D, and if that current's going against you, it is painful. It's like you're coming down the C and D, and you can watch people on the shore walking faster than you. Let's see. Okay, I got Bobby Joe. You took it in Marquette, Michigan. I would say that you probably got a good 104 class out of that. Any 104 class where they're actually teaching paper-based and not just punch the buttons is a good course. Can you get your Celestial Navigation cert on this trip? No,
No.
because you're not going to be offshore far enough, long enough to do that. And so many people don't have that 107, 117 level training yet.
Well, there's two reasons. One, for what Frank said, but also that's not appropriate for that level of a cruise, and we don't want to get involved in celestial navigation details, which can get very deep at times, and detract from what we're trying to focus on in this cruise. There are so many requirements that we have to satisfy that we don't want to be diverted from that. So we
I
don't
have a
do celestial.
comment. I have a comment.
Tom
Go
and Frank,
ahead.
I think we're missing one bit of information here. He's talking about celestial. Celestial is not a course you take on board.
Right.
Well,
Yeah.
yeah, the celestial, what we do is we have a classroom course, an online classroom course for celestial, same as coastal navigation. And we do the celestial hands-on training on our ocean training cruises when we're going to Bermuda. So that's when we do the celestial hands-on training.
Yeah. Quite a few, this is a comment slash question. Quite a few navigational aids are being decommissioned. How do you think this will impact the next cruise? Hopefully it won't impact it. We won't run into any of them.
I'm not sure what he means by decommissioned. A lot of them are being converted. And if the Coast Guard decommissions a particular buoy, let's say, and doesn't replace it with something else, it's probably few and far between. But they have been doing a lot of converting from buoys to day beacons, basically, or lighted day beacons.
And yeah, we are starting to see some of the synthetic AtoNs too, the ones that are showing up on AIS, which is part of the reason why we do run AIS. It's because there are some of those buoys out there that kind of only exist in the cyberspace. But one of the things that we do as part of our nav preps is we go through the local notice to mariners and we make sure that what we think is there is there. Many years ago, coming down the bay, or no, I'm sorry, coming down the ocean front, we were looking for a red number two at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay that had not been listed in the notice to mariners that we checked. And when we got into Cape Charles City Wednesday evening, we looked and it had appeared in the NOTAMs or in the Notice to Mariners that day because it had been pulled off station the night before. So sometimes you're just there.
Well, and to that end, what we do as far as this nav prep, of course, we're looking at the chart, we're looking at the Coast Guard light list, which lists every one of the navigational aids and a lot of the private navigational aids, whether they're lighted or not lighted. And then we look at the notices to mariners that Frank is pointing out, and that comes out weekly, and it's a listing of all the changes that have taken place in the past week. And you can get that in two versions. You can get just the changes in one version, and you can get the complete current version. And then the Coast Guard also has what they call broadcast notices to mariners, where they will put out emails, and you can subscribe to their emails to get the latest condition. And if there's a change that occurred midweek, so it's not in the notices to mariners, you would get an email on that. And then they also, for things that are very urgent, the broadcast notices are broadcast over VHF radio. So the Coast Guard has it pretty well covered. If you are, and we go through this in detail in our nav course, but if you're aware of these features, it's very easy to keep up to date with pretty much real time. So the chart may be quite a bit out of date. The light list may be a week out of date. The broadcast notices to mariners may be a day out of date. And the VHF radio broadcast may be minutes out of date. So.
All right, looking at the clock on Tom's wall, we got about 5 more minutes, so we're gonna cover these last two or three questions real quick, and then we'll be wrapping up. So clearly, there's a lot going on during the trip with navigation, port and starboard watch standing, et cetera. Could you give us an idea on what days are like for the students? Like, how do you handle meals and routine ship's work? Basically, the students are on a rotation, noon to six, 12 to six. So a lot of times they'll have breakfast between the watches. They'll have lunch between the watches, and then we have dinner. Basically, one watch team will prepare dinner. We'll eat dinner at six, and then the other watch team cleans up from dinner.
And the way I do it basically is breakfast is pretty much you're on your own. We show the crew what's available, whether it's hard boiled eggs or whether one of the crew wants to volunteer and make omelets. There's cereal, there's bananas, there's yogurts, there's all kinds of stuff. So you basically take care of yourself for breakfast. For lunch, on my cruises, I usually make sandwiches for lunch. And then, as Frank pointed out, the off watch will prepare dinner. And then when the other watch section comes off watch, they will do the cleanup.
Yep. Have you ever hunkered in Cape Henlopen before doing the Atlantic leg? I never have. I've always gone straight through.
Oh, in other words, before, yeah, here's the thing that we're normally pretty good for on our weather forecasting from 1 to 2 days out. So if it looks really bad when we're in the Sandy Canal at Summit North Marina, we're just not going to depart. We might delay a day, but we'll normally do that delay in Summit North, in the Sandy Canal. And then when that storm blows through, or visibility comes back, or what have you, we'll depart. So I've done that a couple of times where we've delayed in the C&D Canal. I think there's maybe one or two times over the years where we started out and then went into Cape Henlopen, but we like to avoid that.
Yeah, I've stopped in C&D a couple of times, but yeah, I've never once we get down that leg, it's off into the ocean. Comment, I'm just gonna make this comment to Bobby Joe. She says she bought a sextant for Lake Michigan. I will tell you, if you can't do the celestial search on a 106, but if you want to bring it and practice, every time I do a 106 as a master, I bring my sextant just for the opportunity to do sun shots with a clear horizon, or star shots with a clear horizon, just to keep the skills up. And I think I can safely say that any instructor, if you took a class with us and did the 106, any instructor that you're going to be sailing with is going to be able to provide you with some guidance and help on that. We're not certifying, it's not part of the class, but if you want to get some experience of actually shooting sun or stars, please feel free to bring that sextant. Diane Loughton said we did a circumnavigation July 1 to July 5 from Annapolis last year. Recommend it because of all the fireworks we got to witness, except on the overnight offshore passage, made up for the hot, boring C&D transit. Yeah, that would be the thing that would have to make up for that C&D transit. That is terrible.
We try to keep the boring part out of it by always having some activities to do, some learning activities, and therefore we're not so much bored when the current is against us.
One last question. Anything special to be aware of about military traffic in the bay, etc.? I'm going to make this comment real quick. It's not a bay thing, but we have had a couple of times that a rocket launch going off from Wallops Island out near Assateague has closed off part of the ocean. And yes, they will close the ocean, and has stopped us from passing through that area while we're waiting for the rocket to take off or not take off. That we track that. That is in the local notice to mariners. That is in the broadcast notice to mariners. And we actually contact Wallops Island. There's a special number at Wallops Island. If they're going to be doing anything like that, we call them and say, "Hey, we're going to be passing through this area. Are we going to be okay? Or should we start earlier or leave later?"
Years ago, I was coming up the bay, and they were going to do a bombing run on those targets in the bay. And they contacted us on VHF, and they said, "Would you please divert your course to the west so we can do our bombing run?" And they told us what VHF channel to listen to, and we heard the pilot talking to the control tower. The plane took off, and we saw the plane go up, do a power dive, and do a bombing run. Without explosives, but he pitched a bomb, and there was a big water geyser that came up. So you don't want to be caught there.
Rita, do you want to handle this last question?
Yes, so sure. So Charlie asked, how often does the course run and what is the cost? So this year, we do two or three a year, and we Our first two are full now for this year, so we just added one for October. And cost, good question. I would have to look it up.
It's for something.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's
Okay,
four.
4,200.
Yeah,
Does
something
that
like
ring?
that.
Yeah, let me look.
And that covers the boat, that covers the food,
Yeah,
except
40.
for when we
4100.
Yes, Bobby Joe, you need to move here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we thank everybody for coming. And again, look forward to seeing us. If you didn't catch the, if you weren't here, this will be posted on YouTube in about a week. It'll be posted on our podcast in about a week. And we'll look forward to seeing you again. Now, next month, I will not be here. Tom will be with a special guest host next week or next month, because I'm going to be in Bermuda or near Bermuda or coming back from Bermuda. I'll be somewhere. But you will not hear my dulcet tones. It'll be all Tom and a special guest host. And again, we look forward to seeing you some more. Good night.
Thanks, everybody.
Well, that about wraps up this episode. Check back with us in a couple weeks, where I'll be talking about things I consider important for our log keeping and things that I think are important for yours. See you then.